really honored to welcome Professor Smadar Rosenzweig, who hails from Queens and came in very early this morning. She's a professor at Stern College, among many other things, and a mother of seven children, and is very, very busy, and really, really appreciate you coming out here, and we're very much looking forward to hearing your Shiur and Gilad Esther.
Okay, it's really a pleasure for me to be here this morning. Because it's Chodesh Adar, we are going to speak about Megillat Esther. You all saw, and I saw the poster downstairs, so we all know we're discussing Megillat Esther. I hope everyone has the sources, because we're going to work through sources. Even if you don't look in the sources, you'll be able to understand, but it'll definitely be highlighted, because we're going to do a lot of textual work, so you'll really appreciate it much more. I want to thank Yonina Jacobson for inviting me and doing all the details. I also want to welcome and actually honored that a lot of my Talmidot are here. A lot of wives and my husband's Talmidim are here. A lot of old acquaintances are here. And Rebbetzin Schmidman, I think, here is one of my oldest Talmidot when I really pretty much just started out. So we really, all of us, go way back here. So it's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. What we're going to do today, I'm going to speak a little quickly because I really want to get everything in and be a yeke and finish on time and be able to take some questions. What we're going to do today is really a study of intertextuality. What does that mean? That means that we're going to study Megillat Esther in light of other places in Tanakh. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to see that that's really the way Chazal and the Gemara want you to look, not only at Megillat Esther or in general to places in Tanakh. And that's what we're going to do today. To give you an example of what we're going to do, I'm going to give you, in a nutshell, another idea that you could do in an intertextual way, and that will really be an example, right, of how we do this kind of thing in Tanakh. The topic that I gave today was role models, continuity, legacy, right, tikkunim, that we see in Tanakh, and what does that mean? That means that later in Tanakh, many events happen that really take their cue from earlier places in Tanakh. We have the idea of ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim. When things happen in Tanakh, there are two ways to look at it. Number one, that later generations see earlier generations as role models and model their activities on earlier events. And also how later generations see the earlier events and decide to do a tikkun, a restoration for those kind of things. For example, right, you are a product of your parents. Either you will imitate exactly what your parents did, because they're amazing role models for you, or, right, they taught you certain ideas and certain values, and you do continue those values, but there's certain things that you want to tweak, that you want to really up the ante and move in a different direction. So you're taking the values that you learned, but you're also going to step it up a bit. You're going to move in a different direction. So let me give you an example of one thing in a nutshell that we have in Tanakh, and that will really be the exemplar for us and the archetype for us of how we are going to model this shi'ur. So, for example, we know about Lot. Lot in Tanakh left from Ur Kasdim, he leaves from Haran, and he travels with Abraham to Eretz Canaan. Right? Everyone remembers the story of Lot. How would you describe Lot? What would be the characteristic? If you had to characterize Lot, there's going to be an interactive shi'ur, just to let everyone know. If you want to answer, raise your hand. These are not rhetorical questions. If you had to describe Lot, right, how would you describe him? What would be the characteristic that you would describe Lot?
He's a survivor.
Okay, he's a survivor. What else? Yes?
Belligerent.
Okay, belligerent. What else about Lot?
He's misguided.
He's misguided. Okay, we're getting a little closer.
Follower.
He's a follower, but he's a follower in what way? Let's refine this a little more. Yeah. Lot is a follower.
Pragmatic.
What? He's pragmatic. Every time we see Lot, he's always mentioned with Rechush. But Lot is someone who always goes halfway. Lot can never complete any activity that he does, and we see that he's misguided by the fact that even when he has a chance to do something independently, where did he choose to go? So number one, what does Lot do? He leaves Eretz Ur Kasdim and Eretz Haran, and where does he come with Abraham? To Canaan. So what do we expect from Lot? That what legacy is he going to continue? He's going to continue Abraham's legacy. But because they have too much possessions, right? Because he's so pragmatic and the possessions really play such a big role in his life, what happens at one point? Because they have so many possessions, what do they have to do? They have to split. And where does Lot choose to go? What city does Lot choose to go? Lot choose to go to Sdom. What do we know about Sdom? That's the most evil, right, city that we have in all of Tanakh, practically, right? They are corrupt, right? So what does that show? Did Lot really internalize all the messages of Abraham? No, because when he has to make an independent decision, he doesn't act in the right way. So Abraham, really, his whole reputation is the idea of going all the way. Ish emunah, someone who really is totally devoted to Hashem, even willing to do the akedah, and yet Lot always does things half-heartedly. He's willing to go to a certain place, but he's not willing to go all the way. Let's fast forward to Megillat Ruth. Exactly, as I said, this is going to be, in a nutshell, what we're going to do with Megillat Esther. What do we know about Ruth? What is Ruth's lineage and genealogy? Where does she come from? She comes from Moab. Who is really the forefather of Moab? It is Lot. Lot is really the father of Moab and Ammon. Ruth comes from Moab. She's Ruth HaMoaviah. So we see that Ruth is really the progeny of Lot. Who else is the progeny of Lot? Orpah. Orpah is also the progeny of Lot. When Lot, right, has to go with Abraham, he goes with Abraham. He initiates the travel, but in the end, he can't do it all the way. He can't complete the cycle and really connect himself with Abraham and Abraham's derech. When Ruth and Orpah are leaving Moab with Naomi, both of them have to make a choice. And what's going to be their choice? When they leave with Naomi, are they going to leave with her and attach on to her all the way? Or are they going to make the choices like Lot? And what do we see in Megillat Ruth? What does Orpah decide to do? Come on, no one in behind the machitza. There are a lot of places here. Come on. It's unacceptable. We have a lot of places here. What does Orpah decide to do? Orpah comes, she just takes a few steps with Naomi, and what happens in the end? She turns back. Her name defines her. Orpah, back of the neck. Orpah goes some of the way with Naomi, but what does she do in the end? She turns back. So whom does she imitate? She imitates Lot. Good intentions, go part of the way, but she's not consistent. She can't do it all the way. But what do we say about Ruth? Verut davkaba. Ruth cleaves onto Naomi, and Ruth decides to join the Jewish people to be totally dedicated to Hashem. She marries into the Jewish community, and in the end, she really merits that she's going to have David HaMelech. Which means, what does Ruth do? Ruth looks to her past and has a decision to make. Is she going to imitate Lot? Or is she going to really lidbok bit Naomi? Is she going to go all the way? What about Orpah? Orpah looks into her past, and what does she do? She really imitates the actions of Lot. And in the end, what happens, according to the Midrash, right, we know David is progeny of Ruth, but Goliath is seen as progeny of Orpah. And they have the ultimate confrontation. In the end, who wins? David. Which means ultimately, what will really conquer and what will succeed? The idea of doing things till the very end. The idea of Emunah Bashem. So this is the idea that you have to see all of Tanakh, right? You have to see it as really cycles within itself, and that things really carry information and also carry traditions from earlier places in Tanakh. And this is what we're going to do with Megillat Esther, which means, can you read or should you read Megillat Esther really isolated? It's only one Megillah, it's a story that has nothing to do with anything else in Tanakh? Or is Megillat Esther really within the bigger context of Tanakh? And what's fascinating to us is that Megillat Esther is one of the last pieces, chronologically, that we have in Tanakh. So does it really resonate with early material? Is it really seen as kind of a culmination of earlier material or not? So what we're going to see today is absolutely it does, right? Of course, it resonates with a lot of earlier material. And not only does it resonate with earlier material, it's written in a way that you should look earlier. And not only is it written in a way to answer earlier questions and to finalize earlier ideas, but the Gemara and Chazal tell us that that is the way to read Tanakh. And that is the way to read this material. Don't just read a pasuk itself. Don't read a sefer even by itself. You have to see it within a bigger context. So that's what we're doing today. So we're going to read it intertextually, and we're going to see that that's the way, really, the Chachamim want you to read Tanakh. So, with that introduction in mind, we're going to get to the material itself. Now, how are we reading it intertextually? The way we're going to read it is the idea, and I'm going to give you some of my conclusion in the beginning, so you'll be able to really read it in the way we want to read it. In Tanakh, we have the idea of Shevet Binyamin. Shevet Binyamin is a very important Shevet, right? The Benjamin Shevet, the Benjamin tribe. And Shaul HaMelech, Saul the king, comes from the tribe of Benjamin. But what do we know about Saul? Does he continue? No, he doesn't continue. Who really takes over after Saul? David. David HaMelech, David takes over after Saul, after Shaul HaMelech. And the question is why? What were the failures of Shaul? And our question is going to be, do any people in Shaul's family do a tikkun or really try to fix up the mess that Shaul made or the decisions that Shaul made? Does anyone really revisit them and do it in a different way to actually redeem the family name of Shaul? Or do we think Shaul, he tried, he was a failure, and that's it, and now we're going to the Davidic dynasty? Or do later generations in Tanakh really see that they should redeem the family name of Shaul? And what we're going to see today is that absolutely yes, right? We'll see that later generations see themselves within the context of their earlier history. So let's open up. We're doing source number one. A lot of you have the English. I'm going to try to have the English side by side so you'll all know where we are. We're starting with source number one. And we're starting in the middle of Megillat Esther. So our source number one, page one, for those who have the English, it's page one, it's Esther chapter two. And we're starting with verse five. The translations here is not as good, so the textual nuances will be lost on you a little, but look back to the Hebrew and you'll see what we're discussing. What is Megillat Esther? Oh, there are sources. Are there extra sources? If not, then look on the Chavrusa. That's also a very good thing, sharing. Right? So look inside the Chavrusa.
Okay, if anybody needs extra, they'll be over here.
Yeah. Okay, we're beginning. We're in Perek Bet, chapter 2, we're in verse 5. When we describe Mordechai, right, we all know that Mordechai and Esther, right, are the hero and the heroine of our story. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan habira, u'shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimei ben Kish ishimini. When Mordechai is described to us, he's identified to us as a Yehudi. I don't like the English translation as Jewish, because really it means someone from the tribe of Judah, in a sense. He's a Jewish, but he's also from the tribe of Judah, right? And he's also a Yemini. He's from the tribe of Binyamin. Right away, what is Mordechai? He has a double identity. He's Jewish, or he's from Judea. He's from Shevet Yehuda. But on the other hand, he's from Binyamin. He's from Benjamin. So which one is he? Is he Yehudi? Is he from Judah? Or is he from Benjamin? From the names, we see for sure he's from Binyamin. For sure he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And not only is he from the tribe of Benjamin, look at number 12, which is the top of page 3. Turn to page 3, which is the top of number 12, which is the top of page 3. What do we see? Vayhi ish mi Binyamin ushmo Kish. Ben Aviel, Ben Tzror, Ben Bechorat, Ben Afiach, Ish Yemini, Gibor Chayil. Velo haya ben ushmo Shaul, Bachur Batov. Mordechai has the same lineage as whom? As Shaul HaMelech. Which means Mordechai is a direct descendant of Shaul HaMelech. If you look at all the names, though, the names are not in the same order. Right? Even though the same names are mentioned, they're not in the same order. So number one, even though Mordechai is from Shaul, the names are not in the same order, but it really wants to tell us that Shaul, right, is really the ancestor of Mordechai. So the Megillah wants to start, when it talks about Mordechai, that Shaul is the ancestor of Mordechai. But on the other hand, how does it start and describe Mordechai? With which designation? That he's Yehudi. So he's from Judea, or he's from Benjamin. Which one is it, and why do we have a double identity? And that's also going to be a very important theme in the Megillah. Who are you? And that's also why we get dressed up, and that's why you're unknown, and that's why we have Esther as well. We're going to see that she also has a double identity. Let's go back to Perek Bet, number one, source number one, also page number one, page one in your English. when we discuss Esther, who is she? Look at Pasuk Zion, right? Verse 7. Vayhi omnenet Hadassah. What is Mordechai to Esther? He takes care of Hadassah, he Esther. So what about Esther? What does she really come with? Also a double identity. She's Hadassah and she's Esther. And the question is, why does she have a double identity? And also it tells us she's Yifat Tor v'Yifat Mareh. But look further on in these psukim, right? Every time we designate Esther, what kind of verbs are used to describe Esther? In verse 8, Chet. In verse Yud, 10. In verse 16 and 15. 16, actually, that I did for you. And 11. How is Esther always designated in all of these psukim? How is she designated? Passively. Every time we designate Esther in all these things, she's passive. Not only passive, what did Mordechai tell her to do? She can't say anything about her identity, which means Mordechai, right, is described as Yehudi, he is from Binyamin, and Esther is totally passive. Not only is she naturally passive, right, but Mordechai is telling her to be totally passive. And here we have Mordechai from the tribe of Judah. In general, what do we know about the tribe of Judah? What do we know about the tribe of Judah and about David HaMelech? In general, how are they usually described? What are the verbs we usually use about Yehuda? Vayigash elav Yehuda, right? Vayigash David el haplishti. Shevet Yehuda always step up. What do we know about Mordechai in the Megillah? How does he always act? He's very frontal, he's very public. He doesn't bow down to Haman. He always makes a statement. And what about Esther? Early on, she never makes a statement, right? She's passive, she's quiet, and who told her that she has to act in this way? Mordechai. So now we have at least the introduction to the Megillah, right? Esther's a certain personality, Mordechai's a certain personality. We see that Esther is designated doubly, she's Hadassah and Esther. We see the same thing for Mordechai. He's Yehudi and he's Binyamin. So the question we're going to ask is how are they going to act, and what is really going to be their designation? Who is really going to come out, right, in Megillat Esther? So now, with that little introduction in the pshat, in the text, our question is why are they described this way, and what is it telling us? And what I'd like to do is go now to the Gemara, which means, how does the Gemara read this intro about Mordechai? How does the Gemara read this intro about Esther? What is it telling us? And what lesson does it want us to really take with us from this introduction in telling us how are we going to read the rest of the story? Because till now, we weren't introduced to Mordechai and Esther in the Megillah. It was telling about Achashverosh, about Vashti, about the party, right? About making a decree that the men should be important in their families, right? And as a corollary, right, to warn the women, right, the way they should behave, because if you act in a certain way, you're going to really end up like Vashti, right? So in a sense, we understand why Esther behaves in this way. But the Gemara is telling us something very insightful. Go to page 2, and we're doing number 7, number 8, and number 9. Okay, these are the Gemaras. The Gemara not only has halacha. Okay, the Gemara not only has halacha, the Gemara has agadata. And when the Gemara has agadata, the Gemara is really giving you a peirush to Tanakh. All through the Gemara, we have agadatas, we have drashot, we have explanations, we have homiletic and hermeneutic explanations of the Tanakh, of the really corpus of the Bible. And when Chazal give us their agadata, they are telling us not only what the words mean, they're telling you how to read the text. What do they want you to get out of the text? So we're reading the Agadata Megillah, the Gemara Megillah, in Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet. We're going to go to Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, and we're going to go to Yud Gimel Amud Bet. So we're going to read this whole piece, right, about the Megillah in the Gemara. And what is it telling us? So on number 7, you'll see that number 7 in the when I transmitted the file, right, it only said Mud Bavli. So it's number 7. So 6, right? What comes after 6? Number 7, so that's what we're up to. So the Gemara asks the question, why is he called Ish Yehudi? Hayah b'Shushan Avirah. And then it says Ish Yemini, which means, is he from Judah or is he from Benjamin, right? Is he from Yehuda or Binyamin? So if we wanted to really give his real Yichus, right, who is he? He's really from Benjamin. So why are we giving this whole introduction? So this is very interesting, and this is for people who are like Tanakh aficionados, right? Don't Tanakh anyone, right? So this is the story that the Gemara said. You look inside while I explain it. And there's also a translation in English, number 7 in English. 7, 8, and 9 is what we're doing right now. So if you want to look in the English, you can look in the English. The two families, the two communities of Judah and of Benjamin were arguing with each other and saying, who is really responsible for what went on in Am Yisrael. Who's responsible? So if you say Judah, because David was the king, right? And David is the one who runs everything. So David played a very important role in leading Am Yisrael. But there was one very important incident that when David was running away from Absalom, this is a really a bikinis point for those who know it, but you'll see it played out throughout our shiur. When David was running away from Absalom, who's Absalom? David's son. And what did Absalom do to David? Rebels against him. And not only does he rebel against him, what does David have to do? He has to run away from Yerushalayim. And Absalom became king for a while. Then when David finally can get back his kingdom, he comes back to Yerushalayim, and who meets him on the way? Shimi ben Gera. What family is Shimi ben Gera from? He's from Binyamin. Not only is he from Binyamin, from whose family is he? From Shaul HaMelech's family. He's from Shaul HaMelech's family, and he curses David, and he stones him. If you stone or curse a king in Israel, what is your punishment? Death penalty. What does David decide to do with Shimi? Death penalty? Or he gives them amnesty? He gives them temporary. Who said that? Very good. He gives them temporary amnesty. Right? Because he makes Shlomo take care of him later on. Okay? But he gives them temporary amnesty and he says, leave him alone. He has reason to curse me. If my own son is rebelling against me, for sure the family, right, who I usurped their position as king, right, Shimi, who comes from Shaul HaMelech, right? So for sure he can do this. So David lets Shimi live. As a result, Shimi has children. And who comes from Shimi ben Gera? Who comes from Shaul HaMelech? Mordechai. So the Gemara goes on and says, look what David decided at a very important part in history. What does David decide? David decides that he is going to let Shimi live. And as a result, later on, when Jewish history needed Shimi's family, needed Mordechai to take care of Haman, who was there? Mordechai was there in order to take care of everything. Which means the decision that David made to have rachmanut, right, to have compassion on Shimi at that moment was the right thing to do, because later on in history, what happens? Good things result. So what is the Gemara saying? You have to read Megillat Esther in light of what? The events that happened earlier. Another point the Gemara makes, right? On the other hand, what was one of the biggest failures of Shaul HaMelech during his lifetime as king? And we're going to see this inside. But we have to say it before we read it inside. What was one of the major decisions that Shaul HaMelech made, that Saul made in his lifetime as king, that was really a wrong decision? Okay, we're in time, Parshat Zachor, right? Shabbat Zachor. Shaul HaMelech, Saul the king, was supposed to kill out all of Amalek. That was one of his jobs as king. Instead of killing out all of Amalek, what does he decide to do? Who does he leave alive? Agag Melech Amalek. And according to the Megillah, what is Haman called? Ha-Agagi. So where does Haman come from? He comes from Agag. Who left Agag alive? Shaul HaMelech left Agag alive. What? Ah, so according to the Midrash, great question. According to the Midrash, right, because he leaves him one night, he has relations and he has children, and it's really the children. Same thing with Shimi. Even though Shlomo takes care of Shimi later, it was enough time to have children. It was enough time to leave your legacy, your biological legacy here on earth. That's exactly an excellent question. So the point is that the actions that you do earlier, here Shaul has compassion. And what kind of compassion does Shaul have, correct or incorrect? According to incorrect compassion, because he leaves Agag, what's going to happen in the legacy of Jewish history? We're going to have these terrible enemies, and we're going to see the results. Okay? So by the Midrash, by the Gemara saying these things, what is it saying? How do you have to read Megillat Esther in light of what? In light of all the earlier activities that took place. And the question is, what are Mordechai and Esther going to decide? Even furthermore, how does Esther behave? Look at number 8, right? That was number 7, right? How does number 8, right? We're in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. That was about Mordechai and his legacy. What about Hadassah? Why do we call her Hadassah and Esther? On the one hand, Esther Shema, really her name is Esther, so why do we call her Hadassah? Because she is like Hadassim, and Hadassim always in Tanakh, right, and many times regarded as like tzaddikim, right, because they're stable, right, the hadas that we take, the myrtle that we take on Sukkot, but it's average, it's green, right, it's not anything special, it's not tall like the lulav, and it doesn't smell great like the etrog. So what is it about Esther and Hadassah? She's average, which means she is every woman. Usually in Tanakh, right, we either have women who are amazing, right from birth, they show leadership qualities, or we have women who are really sleepers and then later on become something. And the point about Esther is that she's one of those heroines that really doesn't really portray her greatness. We don't see her great qualities right at the get-go. We only see it later on. Who in Tanakh do we have as women characters who right away from the beginning already show certain leadership qualities? Miriam, right at her birth, already she's speaking to Bat Paro. She always steps up. She sings Shirat Hayam. She's always standing up and saying what she thinks. What about Rivka? Right away when we meet her, what is she? She's Riza. She acts with alacrity. What about Chana? What about Chana's personality? How is Chana always described in the beginning before she does anything? How is she described? Everything's passive, and what's the only action she does? She cries. She's upset when Penina, right, her sister-in-law, the other wife, Sarah, always gets her upset, which means Chana in Tanakh represents for us also every woman. We don't know her lineage. We don't know where she comes from, right? She's passive in the beginning. Penina, who is her tzara, the second wife to the same husband, Elkanah, makes fun of her, and how does she react? She doesn't react. She cries. She gets upset. Only after she realizes that her future is in her hands, what does she do? She steps up. So we have two types of archetypes of women in Tanakh. We have one who right away have those leadership qualities and our personalities that really do something. And then we have those who really don't have those unbelievable flashy qualities in the beginning, don't have charisma, don't have leadership qualities, but they have a lot of qualities that eventually, they later on in life or later on after certain events are going to step up and be someone great. So the Midrash is telling us, what kind of person is Esther? Number one, Masteret Dvareha. She's hidden. And how is she hidden? She does have good qualities, but they're not really unbelievable. They're average. She's green even. She's not even beautiful. But the way she acts, the way she'll develop, that makes her into something. So she is every woman, just like Chana is like every woman. Even think of the name. There's no lineage, and Chana is very close to Chava, the name. Every woman. We don't know anything about her. And that's also what we see with Esther. Esther starts out as every woman, and we want to see how she's going to develop that. On the other hand, right, it says, she lo aruka, lo ktsara, ela benonit. She's average. What's the other point we say about it? What other quality does Esther show in the beginning? She's quiet and passive. Who else in Tanakh was quiet and passive? Shaul HaMelech. Where do we see Shaul HaMelech was quiet and passive? When he is chosen as king, what does he decide to do? Nechba el HaKelim. He hides. When he is chosen as king, he doesn't tell his father or his uncle. So that is a good quality. What does the Gemara say? Also, Rachel was passive and quiet in the beginning. When does Rachel actually become active? When do we see Rachel actually become active in Tanakh? When she takes the Dudaim in order to have children, and she gives Bilhah to Yaakov. But when does she do that? After what? What does she ask Yaakov to do for her at one point? Havali banim. What does Rachel say? Who's responsible for me to have children? Look, Leah's having children all the time. Who's responsible for me to have children? You are, Yaakov, she says. Meaning, it's not my job. It's your job. You're the tzaddik. You're the husband. Right? It's your job. If Leah's having children, that means you're praying for her. Right? So, Havali banim, you have to give me children. What does Yaakov answer her? Hatachat Elokim Anochi Asher Manami Mechpribaten? Who has to act in order for something to happen? You have to act, which means you have to take initiative, which means Rachel is passive till then, and then she becomes active. But her passivity, or her tzniut in the beginning, was positive, because what could she have done when Leah was given to Yaakov in the middle of the night? What could she have done? She could have barged in there and said, hello, this is the wrong sister. It's really me. And the fact that she's tzanua and she doesn't say anything then is really in her favor, because what really happens as a result, and it's an unbelievable sacrifice on her part, that most of the Shvatim come from whom? Come from Leah. So that's an unbelievable sacrifice. So sometimes what is tzniut? What is quietude? Sometimes it really is an unbelievable midah. So here we see that she has that unbelievable quietude, tzniut. And who did she give it to? Rachel is the mother of Binyamin. Binyamin is really Shaul. Shaul is really Mordechai and Esther. So which means on one hand, the tzniut that Esther has is really beautiful because it comes from Rachel. But what's the message also underlying here? Tzniut is great, but, right, and tzniut is always great, right? But at one point, what do you have to do? You also have to act. You also have to take initiative. So the Gemara is saying she's like Rachel, which is great. She has that kind of tzniut. But what happens to Rachel also at one point? What does she have to do? She has to step up. And what is Esther going to have to do at one point? She's going to step up. But the tzniut also had its place in the right time and when it was really supposed to be used. And now we come to the last piece. V'amar Rav Eliezer, Shakadosh Baruch Hu posek gedula la'adam, at the end of the Gemara of number 9. Posek lebanav ulivnei banav ad sof kol adorot. When God, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides that a certain group is going to have leadership, then that leadership is really promised them forever. Which means, if Shaul did not sin, what would happen with the house of Shaul? They would be kings forever. Even though Yehuda, Judah was promised, Lo Yasur Shevet Mehuda, Yaakov and his brachot promises that there will never be a tribe that leaves from Judah. So according to the Ramban, Nachmanides, it's going to be parallel. Which means there would always be Shaul's legacy, there would always be kings from Benjamin, and also there would be a parallel line of Yehuda. And we know this is not impossible, because what happens after Shlomo's time? What do we know happens to the Malchut? The kingdom is split. The kings of Judea and the kings of Israel. But the point is that once Shaul gets leadership and gets kingship, what does this mean? They always have the ability to pull back on that legacy and bring back Malchut to a certain extent. Which means once you get it forever. And what's the only way you lose it? If you lose it. How do we see that in Sefer Bereishit? How do we see that in Genesis? You all know what I'm talking about. How do we see that in Genesis, in Bereishit? Esav is Bechor, but because he doesn't act properly, he loses it. What about Yishmael? Who's the Bechor? Yishmael is surely the Bechor, but because he doesn't act in the way that the Bechor should act, he loses it. What about Reuven? Reuven is definitely the Bechor, but he loses it because he doesn't act in a proper way, which means if he would have acted a proper way, and the Bechor, so too with Cain and Hevel. Cain was the Bechor, because he doesn't act properly, he loses it, which means you always have the ability, once you have a certain position, to get certain benefits and certain merits from that position. But if you don't act properly, you use it. So nothing is guaranteed. So here it's saying, once you get that position, if you lose it, you lose it. But what could further generations do? Can always redeem the family name. Which means it's never forever. Which means in Tanakh, your free choice makes a difference. It doesn't mean that because your ancestor lost it for you, or was a sinner, or was an evil person, you lost it forever. Shmuel comes from what family? Korach. Who was one of the biggest rebellers in Tanakh, especially in Chumash? Korach. Korach and his fellow agitators. And yet, because his son did Shuvah, Shmuel Hanavi comes from them, which means you always have a chance to redeem. So now, let's look at the story of Shaul. So if we're basing everything on the story of Shaul, so let's see what the story of Shaul is. Does it really fit in? And here we're going to go to our Haftarah this week. So everyone turn to number 14. And this is very important for us. What do we read this Shabbat? What's the Haftarah of this Shabbat? This Shabbat, Shabbat Zachor. What's the Haftarah of this Shabbat? The story of Shaul and Amalek, what we're going to read right now. Which means, when the Chachamim set up Parshat Zachor, and reading the Haftarah of Parshat Zachor right before Purim, what are they telling you? How do you have to read Megillat Esther? You have to read Megillat Esther in light of Parshat Zachor. Which means Parshat Zachor always happens before Purim. And when the Haftarot were put together, right, they were put together as a seamless unit to always really designate not only the parasha, but especially the first ones that were set up were the ones that really had to do with the calendars. We all know the Haftarot were first set up in Eretz Yisrael. Those were the first lists that we have. And mostly they were really the Chagim, because they had a triennial cycle. So they have three parashiyot, right, three of the same parasha, and eventually the way things got designated. But this is one of those Haftarot that's universal everywhere. What do you know about Haftarot? many times, what is there? Minhag this, minhag that, right? For Haftarat Zachor, it's universal, because it's one of the earliest ones we have in the Gemara. So what is it about Parshat Zachor, and how do we have to read this perek in light of Megillat Esther, and how do we reflect it back? So now we're going to number 14. We're in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tedvav. Again, we set up the background, we set up the family history, and now we're going to see in Tanakh, in Shmuel, the story of Shaul, and then we're going to read Megillat Esther in light of it. So we're at number 14, Shmuel Aleph Perek Tedvav. We're in Perek Tedvav, and now I'm reading Pasuk Aleph. Shmuel tells Shaul, you know what? Again, it's a very difficult thing for us to understand about Amalek, but he tells him that he has to destroy Amalek, and he has to listen l'kol divrei Hashem. He has to listen to God's voice. And he has to listen to God's voice, and what he has to do in Pasuk Gimel, he has to destroy everyone, and he can't have compassion, which is so unusual for us. Which means, what do we know? We know we have to have compassion about everyone. So this is a very difficult mitzvah. And we understand that it's a very difficult mitzvah, and Shaul has difficulty because it says he has to kill everyone, men, women, children, even the animals. And this is a really very difficult mitzvah. Understandably so. And what happens, Pasuk Hey? Vayavo Shaul ad ir Amalek, vayirev banachal. When Shaul comes to fight, vayirev banachal. And Rashi, for your number 15, Rashi explains, what is it, vayirev banachal? Shaul is worried. He is really debating and saying, this is unethical. This is immoral. I am coming and I'm going to destroy this whole nation, the women, the children, everybody. How could God tell me to do something like this? And he's fighting with himself. And he's saying, we have a law that if there's one dead body killed and we find him outside the confines of the city, right, then we have to do a special mitzvah called Egla Arufa. We have to cut the head of a young calf, right, and all the elders of the city have to come and wash their hands saying we're not responsible. So for one person, anonymous, that we don't know, we're all worried, and we do this activity to show that no one's responsible for one person who's killed. And now Shmuel is telling me that the mitzvah we have is to destroy a whole nation, the women, the children, everybody. So Shaul is very upset about it. But if Shaul is very upset about it, what should he have done? If you have a real dilemma like that, so what do you do? You ask the Navi. You should ask the rabbi. You should ask the Urim Betumim, right? Some kind of other prophetic means of that day. You don't have those debates, and then you go ahead and fight. If you really are sincere about those issues, then what do? You really have to be consistent till the very end and follow through on that if you're really worried about it. But what does Shaul do? Look at the psukim. Shaul kills everybody, right? He kills the women, he kills the children. He takes the shalal, he takes the booty, and Pasuk Chet, what does he do? He catches Agag Melech Amalek alive. And what does he have, Pasuk Tet, on Agag? What word does it say about Agag? What's Vayachmol? He has pity. Who did he have pity on? On Agag, the king. Whom should he have pity on? The babies, the women, the children. And what shouldn't he have taken if this was really a religious war? He should not have taken the booty. He should not have taken the shalal, which means if Shaul was really consistent and was really debating about these issues, then you have to show your consistency in your actions.
Well,
right?
To Shaul, he was afraid of the people. He didn't have the quality of leadership. He was afraid that they would rebel. So he gives them what they want.
So what does that say about Shaul?
He's lacking something
in his kingship, right? If every time he has to do Dvar Hashem, where else did he panic? Where else did Shaul panic before this, his leadership? Yeah?
Well, they have the war, and he's going to kill his son because he said everyone has to fight, and his son didn't know about it, and...
Okay, but what does he say? I'm going to use this later, so it's good you brought it up now. What does he say to everybody to do that his son doesn't listen?
Don't eat.
You have to fast. And was that guided or misguided? Misguided. When you're fighting, you shouldn't tell everyone to fast. That doesn't make it a religious or spiritual war. Also, when he fights against the Plishtim, what does Shmuel say to him? Wait for me to bring up the Korban. And what does Shaul do? He panics and he brings up the Korban early. So what do we see about Shaul? He can't do things till the end. He can't listen to Dvar Hashem. Also, his value system is a little skewed. He can't be a good leader of Am Yisrael. Because he leaves our God alive, he takes the booty, and he kills the women and children. If he really had those issues, he should not have killed women and children. So not only that, what is the response? Shaul is going to lose his mucha. Look on page 4. still the same perek, 27, verse 27, for those of you who are in the English. Oh, those of you in the Hebrew, on page 4, verse 27, Kafzai in the top line. When Shmuel leaves Shaul, what does he say to him? You know, you're going to lose your kingship. And what happens to his clothes? He rips Shaul's clothes, or Shaul rips, right, Shmuel's clothes into a few pieces. And what's the symbolism of ripped clothes here? That his melucha, his kingship, is going to be ended. So we see that Shaul, right, really does not do Dvar Hashem, the ultimate. And not only that, he loses the melucha. He loses the kingship as a result of this. And he doesn't act the right way when it comes to Agag, when it comes to Amalek. So now, what did the Chachamim say? What did Gemara say? How do you have to read Megillat Esther? You have to read it in light of this, okay? You have to read it in light of everything that happens earlier in Tanakh. So that's what we're going to do right now. So we did the earlier part. Now let's read the Megillah. We're only going to read certain pieces, but this is exactly what we're going to do. Go back to page 1, and now we're in Esther Paragimel. Esther chapter 3, for those of you who are in the English. It's also on your page 1. So let's read the Megillah in light of what we just said. So number 1, when Haman wants to destroy the women and the children and everybody in one day, what is he taking revenge for? What is he taking revenge for? Amalek. What Shaul did to Amalek, Haman is taking revenge. Whereas for Shaul and Shmuel, it was Dvar Hashem, it was a time immemorial, religious, spiritual struggle. For Haman, why does he want to get rid of everyone? They're different. They're spread around. They're not all unified.
Mm-hmm. How much time frame is there between that and the story of...
Hundreds of years.
Hundreds?
Mm-hmm. Hundreds of years have passed. Okay, we're almost at the end of Tanakh. Hundreds of years have passed. Shaul is the first king. Okay? So we're talking, this is real future, not till 3 generations later, 2 generations later. Okay? So we're in Perek Gimel. So what did Haman want to do? He wants to destroy everybody, women and children, everybody in one day. And what else? What other word? Ushlalam? Lavoz. Take all the booty, which means just like Shaul killed everybody and took the booty, right? So Haman is going to do payback. So that's why Haman, right, in the same language as we saw with Amalek. But let's go on further. In Perek Dalid, right, when everyone finds out about this law, Mordechai is already not bowing down, right? That's why we have the law set out. And he wants to tell Esther, you have to do something. And what does Mordechai do? We're in number 3. We're in Perek Dalid. Mordechai knows everything that happens, right? And he tears his clothing. Why does Mordechai have to tear his clothing? Because what's happening to Am Yisrael? Mordechai's in charge. He made a decision to stand up to Haman. And what did that cause? B'nai Yisrael's destruction, because Agag was left alive and Haman issued this decree. So what position did Mordechai lose, in a sense, for the Jewish people? He's losing his leadership position. And not only that, it says, Vayizak za'aka gdola amara. He has to cry out, scream out. Who cries out and screams out when he loses something? Esav, number 1. Right? He loses his bracha. And what is Amalek from? Amalek is a direct descendant of Esav. Which means when Yaakov took the bracha from Esav, and he took it in the way that he took it, right? What are going to be? Ramifications. In Tanakh, there are always ramifications. Midah keneged midah. Yaakov tricked his father to get the bracha, so what happens to him when he gets married? He gets tricked right away. This is according to the Breishit Rabbah. This is the view of Chazal. Which means it was right for him to take the bracha, but exactly the way he took it. So what is the result? He has to really get punished, in a sense, for it. Because Esav has to cry, right, when Yaakov took the bracha, what is going to be the result? What is Esav going to have, what is Yaakov going to have to do, or Mordechai going to have to do in the future? He's also going to have to cry. Everything has a result. Everything has a tutsa'ah, a consequence. That's the idea of Maaseh Avot Simcha Levavot, which means everything that you do has consequences. So you have to know how to do it. Even if you do a mitzvah, you have to know how to do it. Because if you do it in a way that's improper, there are going to be ramifications for it. But who else cries out? We didn't read it in the earlier perek. Shmuel also cries out when he finds out what happens to Amalek, what happens to Shaul and his battle with Amalek, and he leaves Agag, which means Mordechai cries out because now something has to be solved. And the question is, who's going to solve it? And really, who's going to be set up to solve it?
Esther.
It's going to be Esther. Which means, till now, we're expecting Mordechai. he already tells, right, Bigdan Vateresh, he already identifies who wanted to kill the king, but that doesn't do the job. And Mordechai is going to approach Esther. And what does he tell her? Pasukhet. Right? He says, you know what you have to do? You have to come to the king and you have to throw yourself down and you have to beg for mercy. That's what you have to do. Lehitchanen levakesh milfanav alama. You have to beg mercy from whom? From Ahasuerosh. And what happens here? Look at Pasuk Yud. We're in Perek Dalet, the fourth chapter, we're in verse 10, Pasuk Yud. Vatomer Esther lahatach vatitzaveu el Mordechai. It took till Perek Dalet for Esther to say something in all of Megillat Esther. Till now, all the verbs about Esther are passive. She is hidden. She is the one who is doing the way of Rachel. She is acting in the way of Shaul, Tsanua, hidden. Mordechai is the one who stepped up. He's the one who was active. He's the one who tells on Bigtan Vateresh that they wanted to poison the king. Which means he is active. He's stepping up. He's acting like Yehuda in this way, but it did not work. Esther, who was hidden till this point, the question is, how is she going to solve it? Is she going to solve it? Does she have what it takes to solve it? So what does Mordechai say? What should you do? Throw yourself down at the feet of Ahasuerosh. That's the way to solve it. Because for Mordechai, how do you solve everything? You step up. He steps up to Haman and showed him, I don't bow down to you. What should Esther do? Throw herself down at Ahasuerosh's feet. And what does Esther answer? Right? She says, I wasn't called to the king. Right? And if I wasn't called to the king and I just show up at the king, what's going to happen? I'm going to be killed. So what does Mordechai answer? And this is very important. Look at Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer Mordechai, verse 13. Vayomer Mordechai lahashiv el Esther. Al tidami benakshech lehimalet beit hamelech mikol hayudim. Don't think that you could hide in the palace. Don't think that you could hide in the palace. Where do we have a daughter of Shaul hiding in the palace and looking at everybody else and looking down at them and thinking that she is separate from everybody else? Michal. Michal bat Shaul. When David is dancing and bringing the Aron Brit Hashem to Yerushalayim, right, what is Michal's attitude? She is in the palace. She looks out the window and what does she say? We don't act that way. We don't go out and do things like that. David, you do things like that. You're public. We hide. We say. We have stature. We have a certain kind of self-confidence. We don't go out and do things with the riffraff. So what is Mordechai telling her? Till now, how is Esther acting? And how did Mordechai tell Esther to act? Who should she imitate? Shaul? Quiet? Tzniut? She should stay removed. She should be like Michal. But what is he telling her now? No. Now it's your chance to step up. And not only that, Kiim hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. Verse 14, again, you have to read it in light of the earlier places in Tanakh. Im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. If you're quiet now, revach v'atzala yavo la'yudim mimakom acher. Where does it say in Tanakh, v'yehi kemacharish? I didn't put it in my source sheet, so see if anyone knows. V'yehi kemacharish. When people make fun of Shaul, because they think he's not worthy to be king, what is Shaul's reaction? Vayehi kemacharish. It's like he's deaf. He doesn't hear it. He's quiet. He doesn't answer back. What does Mordechai say? You can't act like Shaul now. Im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. You can't be quiet now and use the traditions of Shaul. What do you have to do? You have to step up. And not only that. Ve'at ubeit avich tovedu. You and your father's family will be lost forever if you don't step up now. What did we say about Shaul? What did he lose? He lost his melucha. But what do we say in general? If your family is designated, what do you always have a chance to do? You always have a chance to redeem the family name. But now we're already at the end in a certain point in Jewish history here. And what does Esther have to do? He's telling her, you have to step up and do this. Otherwise, your family name is going to be completely lost. Which means, what does Esther have the chance to do? To redeem the family name of Shaul. They mess up, in a sense, right? When he doesn't destroy Amalek completely. And what is Esther's job now? To finish this and do a tikkun for Bet Shaul. So what does he say? Umi odea im la'et kazot higat. What's the next word? La malchut. Which means this is your chance at kingship. This is kingship. And when we talk kingship in Am Yisrael, we don't mean being the wife of Ahasuerosh. Meaning this is your chance in kingship, because what do you have a chance now to do? To undo everything that was done in the past. And what does she answer? Lech knoset kol ayudim. You get everyone together, which means he said throw yourself at Ahasuerus's feet. What is she saying? What was the whole problem with Shaul? Who does he doubt and who he doesn't think really rules everything? Hashem. Because Shaul is told, when you have to do Amalek, you have to lishmo b'kol Hashem. You have to listen to Hashem's word. Now, even when Shaul had doubts, what should he have done? He should have gone back to Shmuel to ask the question. So now Esther says, okay, I'm not throwing my feet at Ahasuerus. What's the first step? We're going to daven. Get everyone together to daven for me, which means we're pushing it all back, which means we realize God runs everything. But not only that, what does she tell everyone to do? And this is your point from before. Yeah. What does everyone fast? And you have to fast the right way this time. Not the wrong way that Shaul did, which means every single action in Megillat Esther is really a response to something that happened earlier. So you all should daven for me. And what does she say in the end, which is a pièce de résistance? V'kasher avadati avadati. What is Shaul's problem even after Shmuel comes to him and tells him he did the wrong thing? What can't he do? He can't accept and take responsibility for everything. What is the great hallmark of Shevet Yehuda and David? What could they always do? Take responsibility. Yehuda says, tzadkami meni. Tamar is correct. What does David do after Chet David and Batsheva? Chatati. Right? What does Shaul do? It takes so many times for us to get him to even say, oh yeah, maybe I was wrong. Oh, people really pushed me. What does Esther say? Bekasher avadati avadati. I take full responsibility, and I realize that the whole family name and the whole name of Shaul and Bet Binyamin is on what? Is on my shoulders. And she takes responsibility. And then we see how she does it. Esther, because what was the big fault of Shaul? Shaul's big fault is that he doesn't kill Agag. So who does Esther want to take care of first? Haman. She makes sure to take care of Haman. And she does it in such an ingenious way that at the party, right, Haman is the first one to go. Which means she makes sure that Haman is going to be destroyed. And it's only because of Esther. Not because of Esther and Mordechai. This is Esther's personal job. She realizes she has to do personally the tikkun for Shaul. So she takes care that Haman is going to be destroyed. Not only that, he is hung and he's finished. But this is very important to see. Not only does that happen, but look at number 5. Perek Chet, chapter 8. For those of you who are doing the English, chapter 8, verse 11. Okay, for those of us doing the Hebrew, we're on page number 2. We're in Esther Perek Chet, verse 8, right? Chapter 8, verse 11, okay? What is the decree? Now, what's the problem that we have here in Megillat Esther? All Bnei Israel are to be destroyed. What would be the smart thing to do? Write a decree that says, don't destroy the Jews. But what do we know in Shushan? What can't you do? You can't change the decree. What can you only do? Give a new decree. So what's their new decree? We're on verse 11. Pasuk Yud Aleph. So everyone, the Jews are given in every city that they can congregate, lehikael, lamod al nafsham, defend themselves, lahashmid, laharog, laabed, et kol chel am medina, hatsarim otam taf venashim ushlalam lavoz. What were the Jews given permission to do? To defend themselves, kill all the army, the men, the women, the children, and what could they take? They could take their booty. But what do Bnei Israel do? Again, a response to Amalek. Right? When Hashem says it, that's one thing. But who's giving this decree now? Ahasuerus says, yeah, you can kill whoever you want, take the booty, take everything. But in order to show that we're not doing it just to get the money, and we're not doing it because we're taking revenge, we're doing it really to defend ourselves, look at the Pasuk, we're in Esther Perek Tet. When the Jews have a chance to take care of themselves, what do they do? Right? In the 14th day of Chodesh Adar, right, Vayahargu b'Shushan Shlosh Me'ot, who do they kill? Ish. They really just defend themselves. They just kill people who are attacking them. They kill the people who are of the army attacking them. What's missing here in the Pasuk? No women, no children. They don't do that. And else, what else don't they do? Ubabiza lo shalchu et yadam. It's an exact answer to Amalek earlier. They don't kill the women and children because here it's not appropriate. This we are Rachmanim. And what else don't they take? They don't take the booty because it's not about the money. It was really about defending their lives. And that is the key here. And not only that, Pasuk Kavzayin, as a result, what happens? Kimu v'kiblu hayudim alehem v'alzaram. According to the Pshat, they accept this holiday. Because what does this holiday symbolize? This holiday symbolizes the close of a cycle. This holiday symbolizes, even not in Eretz Yisrael, this holiday symbolizes the idea that we could be consistent, that we really can, even in Galut, have a certain ability to stand up for ourselves and really continue a cycle, a tradition that comes from other places, that comes from Eretz Yisrael, that comes from ideas, right, that are not really in power now. There's no real malchut now in that sense. But it shows that we are consistent and we are continuity. And that's why the Midrash says, what's kimu v'kiblu? That they keep Torah Shebaal Peh. Which means the idea, if you have leaders that really are respectable and leaders who are consistent, B'nai Israel look at Mordechai and Esther and they say, yeah, they're consistent. They do have respect for the past. They can move forward. They are exemplars for us of Torah and mitzvot and of taking initiative on this kind of sense. And that's why, as a result, what do we see in the end of Megillat Esther? That Esther is really the one who is able to initiate the idea of Purim, right? Batichtov Esther, in the end, is really what we have in Megillat Esther. So what we see in Megillat Esther is very interesting. Number one, Megillat Esther really represents to us the idea of continuity, the idea of tikkun. And also it's an example for us of how do you look to your past? How do you look to the examples of your past? How do you look to your family? How do you look to your legacy? Not only for individuals in Tanakh. Because what the Gemara wants to say also is when you read things in Tanakh, it's not just something that happened then. It's also how do you take it for yourself. And we have two important lessons here. There are many, but the ones that we're going to really focus on today. Number one is that Esther is really designated for us as every woman. Which means she's middle, she's not something flashy or maidish. She comes from a nice lineage. But she's an orphan, right? Even though Mordechai takes care of her, right? She really has to make a name for herself. She has to decide who she is going to be. And Esther, even though she doesn't really formulate herself early on, does eventually. And she becomes an unbelievable important woman in Am Yisrael. Number two, what we see here is the idea of family legacy, which means everyone is really a part of their family, is a part of what their past is. And we have to move ahead with it. But we also have to respect what our family stood for. No matter what, they could have said, oh, Shaul was a chote, Shaul really is an embarrassment to us, and we want to cut ourselves off. No, they see themselves as using their family name and redeeming the aspect that should be redeemed. And on the other hand, using those values that were so important in the family and really moving ahead with them, not rejecting them, using that tzniut to a certain extent, using what the whole idea of Bet Shaul stood for. And that's why in the end, what does it tell us about Mordechai? When Esther comes to Ahasuerus, it says, Vatilbash Esther Malchut. She's willing to take on that mantle. She's willing to take on what her family stands for. And then in the end, what does it tell us about Mordechai? We all say this out loud. It tells us what Mordechai's dressed in. He goes out in royal clothing. Why? Because he too, finally, is able to really step up to that idea. And that's why, in a sense, even though it's not real Malchut in Am Yisrael, it really, they are able to step up and really see themselves as continuity of the past, but also do tikkun. So really, what's for us an important message is the idea of Chodesh Adar and Megillat Esther and Purim. Purim is about v'nafochu. But v'nafochu doesn't mean you become someone else completely. V'nafochu, which means you really want to step up. V'nafochu asher yishlutu hayudim heima besonehem. How do you step up and how do you really put together and use the best qualities of whatever you can do? Right? We have this idea, Bizchut Nashim Tzidkaniot, right? Adar brings us into Nisan, which is Chodesh Agula. Esther is major in Adar, and Bnot Yisrael are major in Chodesh Nisan. Which means we have an unbelievable koach. The Nashim, the women of Am Yisrael, through our learning, through our activities, through our chesed, through our action, through our communal work, through being parents, mothers, involved, in all these different ways, good wives, we have an enormous influence in what happens. And not only is it something that we do outside of the religious circle, it's all about the religious circle. It's all about Torah. It's all about mitzvot. It's all about our strengths. It's all about our intellectual and spiritual capacities. And the idea of Esther is, you could either come forth and you might be a Miriam when you were born. But even if you're an Esther, even if you're a Chana, you have an unbelievable contribution to make in whatever it is. And everyone has that unbelievable innate contribution. It might come a little later, it might come earlier. But whatever it is, everyone has that ability to really step up and be someone special. And everyone's story is different. Esther is different than Chana. Chana is different than Miriam. Miriam is different than Rivka. Rivka is different than Deborah. Devorah also, every one of these nashim represents for us a certain strength that each one of us can tap into. And that's also the idea of Megillat Esther. On the one hand, she's Esther. She's hidden. On the one hand, she's Hadassah. She's also average. But in the end, she really realizes what she has to do and how she has to step up. And that's the idea of Purim for us. The idea of communal, the idea of involved with everyone, the idea of the public, the idea of helping everybody else. Purim is all about matanot le'evyonim, mishloach manot, kriyat megillah, realizing the nes of Hashem, but it's also very much a family-oriented chag, which means we play a very important role, and we are chayiv in every single mitzvah in Purim. Every single, we have to hear kriyat megillah, we have to give mishloach manot, and we have to give matanot le'evyonim, which means we are completely involved in these mitzvot because we are completely involved in the community, and our contributions really make a difference. So we have a beautiful midrash in the end of Megillat Rut in Yalkut Shimoni that says, "Bizchut nashim tzidkaniot shebechol dor nigalim am Yisrael." It's not just the heroines of the past. The heroines of the past speak to us, and we have to look to them as role models and see that we also have an unbelievable contribution to make. And when we read Megillat Esther, it is speaking to us. As Chazal say, they are telling us to look to our past and use our past to really make a different future. Thank you very much.